I think that all of this is affected by the political fragility of the Affordable Care legislation and its implementation. So with that, let me open it up to questions and comments. We'll start with Craig if you'd introduce yourself.
Having just finished the privilege of working with Paul Ginsberg on a paper with the Commonwealth on the effect of physician practice consolidation on pricing, sort of drawing from both this morning and this afternoon, it seems to me the major conundrum is really, can we create effective and efficient group practices that will increase quality and collaboration and coordination of care, and yet be able to compete on cost, both in terms of price and in terms of eliminating wasteful practices? And I'd just like the reflections of the panel, including Karen, on what policy things will tend to tilt us in that direction and away from the opposite in a sense.
Well, I have a well-deserved reputation for switching difficult questions to others. So I'm going to turn to Jay.
Well, thanks. So I think you're asking a very fundamental question. Will this whole idea work? And is it possible to get the triple aim, or are we going to end up with only two parts of it? So I would say that you just saw some evidence about the situation in California. So I would start by saying, why is California, particularly Northern California where I live, which is maybe the second most expensive place in the country to live, why are the healthcare costs lower, significantly lower, and have been that way on a sustained basis? I think it's to some degree it's us, but it's us, my former organization. But I think it's also then imprinted on the marketplace, both at the payer level and at the level of at least integrated delivery systems, that there's a price to be paid for in terms of both money and reputation for not adopting some of the same sorts of changes, because the fully integrated organizations are, as we saw, only about 30%, and yet the whole state on a reasonably fully adjusted basis is a lot less expensive. So I do think that's some evidence that this can work. Where I think it gets trickier is the other part, which is the trend. Because I think it's been very hard for us to deal with some trend issues, particularly those that, and I think I forgot who it was this morning, who brought up, I think it was Richard Foster, brought up the issue of, can we really do this if we have this inexorable technology driver? And I think we've got some technology drivers on the horizon. The genomics was mentioned today, that if you look at it, are pretty scary in terms of what the cost would be. And it's pretty difficult to understand how an organization, or the nation for that matter, even our culture, could simply say, okay, so now we have a test, let's pick something for colorectal cancer that costs $1,000, but it tells you which is the best therapy for you. We're not going to do it. We don't get to the question of whether we have a culture in the United States that would accept NICE or that sort of a decision-making process. I actually don't think so. So I do agree with Richard's point this morning that structuring the organizations well, changing the payment system, creating competition are all kind of, those are givens to get where we need to go. But without some other issues dealt with, and I don't know, how to do that, but certainly coming to grips with the technology driver is one of them.
I might just add a couple of points to that. First of all, what I was struck by in Leora's slides is that differential between the U.S. and California stayed there and widened. So we have a tendency to poo-poo one-time savings and we say, gee, the integrated delivery system model has lower hospitalizations, but after that, then what? But I think that we need to get into a mindset not of poo-pooing one-time savings, but saying we need one-time savings year after year after year. And we need to take 1% of waste out of the system this year. We need to find the best way to take 1% of waste out of the system next year. We need to just And some of this you can get from spread. The second point I'd make on policies is to really take advantage of what we learn from CMMI and rapidly translate successful innovations into policy change throughout, not only the Medicare program, but I would say through commercial insurance as well. And then third, as many of you know, with my colleagues, Kathy Shane and Stu Gutterman, we've also put forward this idea of Medicare Essential, which is giving beneficiaries incentives through value-based benefit design, comprehensive benefit restructuring, to seek high value care, but beyond that, to have effectively a tiered network of financial incentives for beneficiaries to seek care from high value providers. So kind of reinforcing and rewarding with growing market share those providers that in fact are achieving the triple M. So others, Rob, you want to introduce yourself? And then Wendy, you're next.
Okay, Rob Mechanic from Brandeis. I wanted to comment on Bernadette's discussion. Bernadette, you made a big point of really the turnaround of the ACO has a lot to do with implementation and execution. And in that, you need people with A, leadership skills, and B, management, project management skills, which aren't necessarily taught in medical school. So you had the advantage of all the SWAT team from Northern California, but how would you suggest other organizations that are trying to do a lot of change but don't necessarily have the right people, do they make it? Do they have to buy it and bring in people from outside? And how can how can public policy help that?
So if I would say in an organization that is totally alien to the concepts of integrated care or bundled payments or anything along that spectrum, probably you have to buy some leadership and bring it in carrying some of that background. And then also you have to build it or make it yourself. I think, one of the things that to me, in addition to having five people that came with me from Northern California, and this is 5 out of 1,000, but that's enough, 5 people with me. We took about the top 100 leaders in the organization, so the next 10%. And as Jay's alluded to, actually spent a lot of money on them, training them. Now we did that in-house. We brought people that we thought could help bring to them a quick and usable injection of skills around culture development, communication, how you articulate a vision, how you can come up with your vision, and then additionally sort of managing skills, how to have difficult conversations and how to hire for the right stuff. And we had to put a lot of investment into that. And I've had other folks who've heard me say that say, well, you were lucky you had the money to do it. I would say that we didn't have the money to do it, we just did it and recouped the money on the backside. So I think that's one of the things. You just have to be willing to take a little bit of risk and put the money into that development program for physician leaders. And we carried that on. We did a whole lot the first year, but we have ongoing programs for our physician leaders every year. And we're starting to develop what we're calling an emerging leaders track, trying to, because some of us are getting older, Leora, and so we want to have those people that come behind that can take over when we're too exhausted to go home.
Wendy Everett next.
Wendy Everett from Mihai. I was surprised, Karen, as you were, about the decline in commercial HMO coverage and to some degree the decline in employer coverage, although we've seen some of that nationally. As California's exchange grows legs and gets up and running, do you see the power of the exchange as an innovation in ACA as being able to turn that around and make a difference.
The org?
Great. Yeah, so we did have a number of discussions with people affiliated with the California Exchange, the Exchange Board, and this was a really hot topic because there really are two threads of thought in California around one, which I was describing, the integrated care and global budgets, and the other side, which is really a lot of employers saying, this has not worked for us. We haven't seen the results when it comes to premiums. And you know, we're going a different direction. And to some extent, the exchange is trying to kind of muddle between these two different ideologies of greater cost sharing, maybe more limited networks and other ways to kind of lower spending for exchange plans versus more of the kind of fully more inclusive HMOs. And you know, I think it's actually looking like it's a little bit more in the direction of, limited plans, higher cost sharing for consumers. But the exchange in California is going to be a very, very powerful source of potential reform, and they're certainly looking at ways to use their power. For example, they have selective purchasing. They don't have to accept every plan that wants to be on the exchange. And they really have the opportunity to negotiate and create plans that they feel are promoting a better delivery system. And they're looking at ways such as measuring, looking at things like risk or patient-centered medical homes, wellness focus within plans as part of the bid mechanism for what will ultimately be offered on the exchange. But it is a really major debate which kind of direction the exchange is going to pull California more towards.
Here in the back. Yes. Not very good at pointing. Yes.
Sandy Schwartz, Penn. A lot of today we've been talking about structural changes, market changes, payment changes, things like that. But I think it was early days, somebody noted that we referred to something where doctors would be in the same way whether or not they were paid, whether or not they in fact paid for it directly or not. How do you go about, I think it's, we're going to think fundamentally to have to change the culture of medicine. I think the culture of medicine, the reasons we do things for patients or to patients, depending on how you want to look at it. And how do we change that culture of, the information doctors and nurses want as opposed to the information that patients want, and focusing on translating things, do things only that improve outcomes instead of things that make us feel better or make us feel more comfortable. I just wonder if any of you have tried that within your organizations, that type of culture change or leadership.
Let me try. I mean, I talked a little bit about, what I think, anyway, the elements of an effective culture in an admittedly mature kind of ACO, right? I think what's a harder question, and so let me just go back up. So if you assume in that where we're going, delivery system reform, contains at least two fundamental elements. We're going to change payment over time, away from paying for units of service to some sort of prospective payment, starting with bundled payments or moving towards prospective capitation or partial capitation, whatever. And then there's going to be some consolidation as well. Consolidation among physicians, consolidation with hospitals. But those are the two arms of this thing. The question, the unknown question is, how far in each direction do we have to go to get, pick it, 60, 70, 80% of the benefit? What is the complexity effect curve look like? Is it a straight line? In other words, you keep adding all these elements and move up Karen's chart from the southwest corner to the northeast corner, and for every element you add, you get an equal amount of change, positive change, and positive change by this, triple aim, right? Or do you have to add, elements for a while, and then all of a sudden you get an inflection point and you get up there? That has one set of implications. Or is it the reverse? And that is, if you can just get some of the fundamental elements in place, you get a significant amount of change, and then after that, it's kind of incremental. And I think that question, which is, to me, unknown right now. But could